From time to time, we are given a name of perhaps a world-leading authority on a given topic. And it was through the agencies of PAHO, the Pan American Health Association, that we were given the name of Sir Michael Marmot. Sir Michael Marmot is probably one of the top, if not the top, researchers into the social determinants of health. And I would like to give appreciation to our colleagues from PAHO for being able to get Sir Michael to come and address us today. I had not actually met Sir Michael. The name was just given to me. And it just happened that I picked up my American Journal of Medicine, and there was an article that he had written. So we're very pleased, in fact, delighted that we can bring you today Sir Michael. He has spent the morning chairing at the United Nations a committee on these kind of things. He will leave immediately after this and go back to chair for the United Nations meeting. But, Sir Michael, that you would come and squeeze in your lunch hour to address our group here, we were most grateful. Thank you so much.
It shows the power of persuasion of my colleagues at the Pan American Health Organization. So I'm very pleased to be here. Let me say it once. I just came at the very tail end of Gary Fraser's presentation. Let me say it once that I'm not going to talk to you about lifestyle. Much of the work that I'm familiar with from Loma Linda University and in inquiring after the reasons of the good health of Seventh-day Adventists compared with others has to do with vegetarianism, smoking, etc. I'm going to say absolutely nothing about those things. What I'm going to talk about is the social determinants of health, and to ask you, as a religious affiliation, what role religious communities can play. And I'm not going to talk about them, but I'm going to ask you to think about them as I talk about issues to do with inequality and inequity, when I talk about issues to do with community and social cohesion, when I talk about the importance of empowerment. I'd like to ask you to think what role a faith-based community can play in furthering the cause of those issues, because in furthering that cause, you're likely to make an important contribution to promoting equity in health. The Commission on Social Determinants of Health, which I chaired, reported last August 2008, and we entitled our report, Closing the Gap in a Generation. This was a statement, not a prediction. It was a statement that we have the knowledge to make an enormous difference to the health gap in one generation. We have it in our heads to make a difference. It was a statement that we have the means in our hands to make a huge difference to the health gap in a generation. The question is, what do we have in our hearts? Are we prepared to do what's needed to apply the knowledge, to apply the means, to make an enormous difference to closing the health gap in a generation? So it was a statement of what we deemed was possible, at least theoretically, were we but moved to take the actions necessary. Right at the center of what we were trying to do was the issue of social justice. It was put to me that no government would take us seriously unless we could show that improving health equity was good for the economy. That may or may not be true. I was labeled naive yesterday by none other than Mrs. Sherry Blair, who I was sitting next to, the former First Lady of Britain, and I told her when she called me naive that you're in good company, that when I met Margaret Robinson, the former UN Commissioner of Human Rights, and I was having a conversation with her, and at one point she said, God bless you, you're naive. So I have an ideological commitment to naivety. I think we should put social justice at the center of everything. So we should take the action that's needed because it is the right thing to do, not because it'll benefit some mythical bottom line. And we put at the center of what the Commission was trying to achieve empowerment. Empowerment of individuals, of communities, and indeed of nations. And we think of empowerment as material. If you haven't... Can I have some water? Is that possible? If you haven't got the material conditions to feed your children, you can't be empowered. Psychosocial, having control over your life, and political, having voice. All of these are part of empowerment. And what we were trying to do with the Commission was to create the conditions for people to take control over their lives. And that, in a sense, is my message. And we could stop now and I could go back to the United Nations, or I can give you some of the detail. But as I'm here, I'll give you some of the detail. Dramatic inequities dominate global health. We highlighted these figures when we published our report to make a point. In the Scottish city of Glasgow, men in the poorest part of Glasgow have life expectancy of 54. Men in the richest part of Glasgow have life expectancy of 82. A 28-year difference in life expectancy within one Scottish city, people living about 12 kilometres apart. For the Americans here, that's a distance measure. It's a bit big. So dramatic, this 28-year difference, so dramatic is the difference in Glasgow. So dramatic is the difference in Glasgow that the poorest people in Glasgow have life expectancy 8 years shorter than the average in India. When you turn on the tap in Glasgow, the water's safe to drink. People don't die of diarrheal disease. They die of heart disease and cancer and alcohol-related diseases. They just die more rapidly than in the rest of the country. In fact, when we published these figures, the BBC went up to Glasgow and they interviewed one Glaswegian. And you'll be pleased to know I won't try and capture his accent. And they said to this man, do you smoke? And he said, rawr, rawr. And do you drink? And he said, rawr, rawr, rawr. And the interviewer said, do you realize if you didn't smoke or drink, you might live another 15 years? And this is a faith-based community, so I won't repeat exactly what he said. But he said, who wants to live another 15 years in this hellhole? And in a way, he summarized the message of the Commission's report. Don't focus simply on the downstream manifestations. Focus on the hellhole, or the degrees of hellholeness in which people live. So the fact that people in the poorest part of Glasgow can live 8 years shorter on average than men in India tells us how powerful the operation of these social determinants can be, and it's not just a matter of communicable disease. In Washington, D.C., a 17-year difference in life expectancy, and the same sort of considerations apply. For the Americans, I do like to show you Cuba and the United States. This is not one of the greatest successes of American foreign policy. But but then that's not saying much. Having just come from a UN meeting, there is understandably a tendency to focus on the poorest of the poor. But if we target only the poorest 10%, we miss most of the problem. This is under 5 mortality per 1,000 live births in a number of countries. If you look at the figures for India, and these are by wealth quintile, if you look at the figures for India, people in the second top wealth quintile have higher mortality than those in the top. People in the third top quintile have higher mortality than those second from the top. It's a gradient. I've spent my research life studying the gradient in rich countries, and here we see it in poor countries. If you focus only on the poorest of the poor, you miss most of the problem. And that suggests that it's not only an issue of solving poverty, but improving society. You've got to take action across the whole of society if you're going to deal with the health gradient. And that health gradient we see in rich and poor countries. And look at Peru. The top quintile would not look out of place in Europe under 5 mortality. But this graded phenomenon, so the bottom quintile would look very much out of place, but it's a gradient. And what we see in many countries is the slope of the gradient, the steepness of the gradient, has been increasing. These are data for Russia from our own studies, looking at the widening trend in mortality by education. These figures are the probability that a 20-year-old will live to age 65. And you can see between 1989 and 2001 that for those with university education, the probability that a 20-year-old would survive to age 65 increased in a very welcome way. For those with elementary education, it decreased. So the gap widened. And we see that in many countries. I show this to make the point that primarily we're not talking about a health care issue. In the US, expenditure on health care per head of population is about 2.5 times the expenditure in England. And we did this study comparing illness in the US with illness in England from studies of 55 to 64-year-olds. What we see here is the social gradient. This is by income in the US and in England, heart disease. But at each level of income, the Americans had more illness than the English. For 7 major conditions, the Americans had more illness than the English. In fact, I watched a video of Michael Moore's movie Sicko with my family, and you could hear at one point, he shows the title of the paper we published in the Journal of the American Medical Association. And then you hear at one point this voice saying, for 7 major conditions, the Americans had more illness than the English. And my kid said, hey, that's Dad. And my street cred in the family went up like this. I wasn't acknowledged by name, so this is a very arcane pleasure that is my kids recognize my voice. Now, when people, and this is going on in the US at the moment, when people think about disparities in health in the US, of course they think first about the fact that 48, 49 million Americans don't have health insurance. And there are discussions going on, discussions that I have to say in passing do not make me optimistic, but there are discussions going on at the moment about trying to deal with that issue. But this is not primarily about lack of access to healthcare. 92% of the people in the American sample had health insurance, and everybody in the top two income tertiles had health insurance. This is not primarily about lack of access to health care. Inequities in health do not equate to inequities in health care. And in case I didn't say that clearly enough, inequities in health do not equate to inequities in health care. Inequities in health arise because of the circumstances in which people are born, grow, live, work, and age. And I'm delighted to say that that phrase has now got into the thinking of the UN Secretary General. He may not know where it comes from, but it comes from the report of the Commission on Social Determinants of Health. And when he opened the session yesterday of the Economic and Social Council, he used that very expression. So the social gradient, we see it everywhere. This is Porto Alegre in Brazil. High, medium low, and low socioeconomic levels of district, and cardiovascular disease. And here the investigators have looked at the proportion of cardiovascular disease deaths that could be attributed to having a socioeconomic level below that of the highest. So we see this social gradient everywhere. Increasingly, of course, in low-income countries, non-communicable disease is emerging as a dominant cause of morbidity and mortality. Low-income countries here, this is the burden of disease due to HIV, TB, and malaria, other infectious diseases, maternal, perinatal, and nutritional conditions. And you can see that these conditions are about equally balanced with non-communicable diseases and injury. By 2015, the non-communicable disease and injury will predominate, and by 2030, they'll totally dominate. Now, that's really very important, because if you believe, as I do, that the causes of these diseases and injuries are the same wherever we find them, that means we've got to make common cause between people living in low-income, high-income, and middle-income countries, because increasingly we're suffering from the same conditions. And what's happening at the moment is the so-called double burden. If you look at GDP per capita of countries and look at undernutrition, stunting, and obesity by GDP, stunting goes down as GDP goes up, obesity goes up as GDP goes up, and these countries in the middle have the double burden. The children are stunted and the adults are obese. Never seen anything more gruesome than going to a swimming pool in Mexico and seeing 11-year-old boys that looked like they were 25-year-old women because of the problem of obesity in children of middle income and higher income in a country like Mexico, at the same time as they have malnutrition of the children. Obesity patterns across the developing world. There's Mexico. 79.6% of the Mexican population are overweight or obese. Women in Egypt, 70% overweight or obese. My Egyptian colleagues, who are almost all female, don't like me showing this slide. They feel slightly uncomfortable. But it shows that obesity is an issue across the developing world. The Commission on Social Determinants of Health was invited to New Orleans by David Satcher, former Surgeon General, who was a member of the Commission. And the point that he wanted to make in inviting us to New Orleans was not to hit the government round the head about what they did or didn't do in reacting. His point was that an external shock like Hurricane Katrina, as he put it, exposed the fault lines in American society. Key characteristics of the Louisiana population pre-Katrina percent African American compared in Louisiana compared with the U.S., 32% versus 12%. Percent of children living in poverty, 28% versus 23%. Percent of people living in poverty, percent of non-elderly uninsured, percent of non-elderly with Medicaid. On a whole raft of these measures, the people of Louisiana in general, and New Orleans in particular, rank 49th, 50th out of U.S. states on these measures of poverty disadvantage. I noticed when I was looking at these statistics, on one measure, Louisiana ranked 51st out of 50 states, which confused me slightly. Somebody told me that's because sometimes they count Washington, D.C., so that... The anniversary data, the one-year anniversary after Katrina, 1,400 lives lost, 900,000 people displaced. The Orleans household population, of course, was reduced. The number of houses with major damage, people in trailers, jobs lost, businesses destroyed, and debris generated. And, of course, the people who are affected overwhelmingly were African American and were in poverty, and those two categories overlap in New Orleans. And what we saw, in a way, was lazy governance, poor governance in operation. When we visited the lower Ninth Ward of New Orleans, it would have been very difficult to buy food for dinner, but very easy to buy liquor, more liquor stores than food stores. There aren't many American households that don't have an automobile. One-third of families living in the lower Ninth Ward of New Orleans did not have household access to a car. The bus service doesn't bear talking about. So, of course, when the flood came, people couldn't get out. Had no transport. It is horrendous. When we look at the heat wave in Europe, the excess of deaths that occurred in France, 14,000 excess deaths, 7,000 in Germany, 4,200 in Spain, and so on. And when we ask who was at risk of dying in the heat wave, it was the elderly, those with loss of autonomy, those who were socially isolated, people living directly below the roof of a building and living in cities, the heat island effect. And the point that I'm making is that external shocks, such as those associated with climate change or the environment, differentially impact the poor and disadvantaged. External shocks, such as the economic crisis, differentially impact the poor and disadvantaged. Our Commission on Social Determinants of Health had three principles of action. The Secretary General has noted this one: the conditions in which people are born, grow, live, work, and age. The second was the structural drivers of those conditions at global, national, and local level. And the third was the importance of monitoring, training, and research. I flashed it up. I'll come back to that quote from Halfdan Mahler. Dr. Mahler, in his address to the World Health Assembly when he was Director General in the mid-1980s, likened health equity to a swamp. Alligators in a swamp. And adapting what he said, imagine we're fighting the alligator, the problem of health equity, and we argue which weapons to use in fighting the alligator of health inequity: immunization of children, promoting healthy lifestyle, getting access to health care. And Dr. Mahler said, when you're up to your neck in mud fighting alligators, remember, you came to drain the swamp in the first place. We've come to drain the swamp. We want to take action on the conditions that lead to health inequities, not simply focus on the downstream manifestation of those conditions. And I would argue and put to you that the Commission's recommendations are aimed at draining the swamp. In the conditions of daily life, we talk about, and we have chapters on early child development and education, healthy places, fair employment, social protection, and universal health care. I said that health equity does not equal inequity in health care, but universal health care, regardless of ability to pay, is of vital importance. And in the structural drivers of those conditions, we talk about health equity in all policies, the importance of good global governance, gender equity, political empowerment, inclusion and voice, market responsibility, and fair financing. The question is anyone listening? And the answer is, surprisingly, yes. I'm not coming here to bring you a tale of woe. I'm not coming here to wring my hands and say, we did all this work and no one's listening. It turns out a lot of people are listening. I already told you that distinguished people have told me I'm naive, so you can apply that correction factor to everything I say. But we had a global conference in London in November 2008. 80 countries were represented, and I'll come back to this announce, the review of health inequalities in England. We had a regional meeting in Sri Lanka. It was very exciting. The Tamil Tigers launched an aerial attack on Colombo at the end of our meeting. That was quite fun. We had a regional meeting in the Eastern Mediterranean, in Cairo. A number of countries are translating findings into program. There was a resolution at the World Health Assembly in May this year calling on the WHO to take action, calling on member states, calling on the international community. And I suppose the fact that I am addressing the Economic and Social Council of the United Nations and moderating a session where countries report on what they've been doing in this area is grounds for some optimism. One of the recommendations that we made and that was picked up in the World Health Assembly resolution was that there should be a global conference where all countries report on what they've been doing in this area. Brazil had its own Commission on Social Determinants of Health. There's President Lula holding the report of the Brazilian Commission. On the whole, I'd say he looks pleased. I had the honor to... I'm busy, tell them. I had the honor to present a copy of our report to Manmohan Singh, the Indian Prime Minister, and we're hoping that action will take place. I mentioned I was in Sri Lanka. The President of Sri Lanka signaled his intention, once his little local difficulty was over, to take action on social determinants of health. We're very much pushing the argument of health equity in all policies. The argument is that health is an outcome of actions that are taken in the social sphere for other reasons. And health equity, the distribution of health, is a measure of how well we're doing in the society as a whole. And so our argument is that there should be health equity in all policies. I was in Norway recently, and the Minister of Foreign Affairs of Norway said, I am a health minister. Every minister is a health minister. And I would say that every sector is a health sector. transport, education, social protection, environment, finance, all crucially engaged in the business of health and health equity, even if they don't realize that that's what they're doing. And health equity is a measure of how well they're doing. We talked about empowerment. These data from British Columbia, looking at First Nations communities, show the importance of empowerment at a community level. These communities were classified according to the number of cultural factors present and the degree of community control over health services, education, cultural facilities, police and fire service. And they looked at youth suicide. What you can see there is the number of cultural and community control present. The greater the number, the lower the youth suicide rate. Community control, cohesion of communities, makes a huge difference to the well-being of young people. And in this dramatic and heartbreaking fashion, shows the relation with youth suicide. And when I asked you at the beginning of my talk to think how a faith-based community could actually internalize some of the evidence that we assembled in the line of doing the commission and ask, what does it mean for action of a faith-based community? It is possible to make a difference to people's lives despite living in poverty. One of our commissioners was a leader of the Self-Employed Women's Association, which started in Gujarat in India, in the city of Ahmedabad, and represents the poorest, most marginal women in India. And when we visited Ahmedabad, we were privileged to get some insight into the vegetable sellers. These women have a small pile of vegetables. They sit in the market, a rag in front of them, the vegetables on the rag, and they sell vegetables for a few rupees. Low income, all the characteristics of poverty. The vegetable sellers, of course, were being ripped off by extortionate loans. They had to borrow money to buy the vegetables. They were paying usurious interest rates. So SEVA, the Self-Employed Women's Association, started a bank, a microcredit scheme. I visited a meeting of the governors of SEVA Bank. I've never been invited to a meeting of the governors of Barclays Bank, but I did go. So I have no idea whether Barclays Bank has women in colourful saris who are the governors. And at the end of their bank meeting, they sing the Gujarati equivalent of "We Shall Overcome." I don't know if they do that at Barclays or Citibank. The women were being ripped off by the wholesalers in the vegetable market, who would buy from the growers at very low prices and sell on to the retailers at very high prices. SEVA became the middle woman in the wholesale vegetable market. The women were being harassed by the police, and SEVA said to these women, do not bribe the police. They pursued to the Supreme Court of India the entitlement, the legal right of these women to pursue their trade. The women sat there with their children in the monsoon rains or the sun. SEVA started childcare provision. The women get sick. SEVA provides health care. And it is a union. This is not a charity. It's a union. It's collective action for the greater good of the whole. Housing, and I'll show you something about that in a moment. And now SEVA has a new problem, pensions. A nice problem to have. So action is possible. And I would say all the social advances that have happened, what history teaches us, is all the social advances that have happened come by collective action, whether it's civil rights, whether it's the improvement of working conditions, whether it's the women's movement, whether it's universal suffrage, or examples that come from India. What's needed is collective action. And what Seva says, if the government won't do it, we'll do it for ourselves. I said I'd come back to housing. Seva asked the members of their union in Ahmedabad, what do you want in terms of housing? They were living in slums. And the first thing the women said was, we do not want to be moved. We don't want to be moved into some little concrete blocks of new housing. We like being where we are, but we quite like running water and a place to cook and bathroom facilities. For $500 per household, they negotiated that. The women themselves had to contribute $50 per household, which is enormous if you're living on a dollar a day or less. And following the investment in these slums, there was improvement in health, a decline in waterborne diseases, children started going to school, the women were able to take paid work, no longer having to stand in long lines to collect water. This is what one of the areas looked like before the slum upgrading, and this is what it looked like after the slum upgrading. $500 per household. We said in our report, half the world's population now live in cities, and 1 billion people in the world live in slums. Scaling up, we put in our report, it would take $100 billion to upgrade the world's slums. And I thought, as principal writer-editor of this report, it's ridiculous. How can we put a figure like $100 billion in the report? Nobody would take us seriously. Who would find $100 billion for anything? I think that last count we're up to $7 trillion to bail out the banks. For 1/70th of the money we found to bail out the banks, every urban dweller in the world could have clean running water. Do we have the knowledge? Do we have the means? The question is, do we have the will? I think he was trying to send me a message, so I'm going to skip over this next bit. I've skipped over the data, but let me just tell you about an experiment in Kenya, which was getting the community, a village, involved in improved nutrition. And again, it was participatory work where the community were deciding what they wanted. Apart from demonstrating improved nutrition, women had extra time on their hands because the community got engaged and the community took a lot of action. They used the extra time gained for childcare, established networks, and to make sure there was representation. I know this will sound incredible, but men chose to spend time with their families. And there was improved farming and representation. And children chose to spend their time in clubs, gaining knowledge and later life skills. And the lessons for poverty from this Kenyan experiment was about enhancing social cohesion that makes intersectoral collaboration possible. And social cohesion is reinforced through participatory social and health planning, impacts on governance and social accountability. When I was talking about the London conference, and I said that action is happening, the Prime Minister of Britain came to the conference and he announced that he's invited me to set up a review in the UK of what we could do. And this is rather important because the Commission's report, the report of the Commission on Social Determinants of Health, was oriented to the whole world. Sub-Saharan Africa, India, Latin America, Washington DC, Glasgow. How can you formulate a set of recommendations that are going to apply equally to sub-Saharan Africa and to Glasgow. They're going to take different form in different places. The fact that the Prime Minister in Britain said, well, we want to know how does the Commission's report apply to the UK, and invited me to set up a review of health inequalities to advise the government on what they could be doing. Modelled on the Commission on Social Determinants of Health, I set up 9 task groups: early child development and education, employment arrangements and working conditions, social protection, the built environment, sustainable development, social exclusion and social mobility, priority public health conditions, economic analysis, and I didn't forget delivery systems. Healthcare delivery is important, but so are these other things. We've made a partnership with people in the northwest of England, in Liverpool, and I went up to have a meeting, believing in community empowerment, with various local groups. And at the end of the day, what they fed back to me, and this is my summary of the feedback, was essentially, they said, we began the day thinking that our problem was that we had poor quality services. And we ended the day realizing that the problem wasn't the services, the problem was society. And as we go forward, what's important is our values. And our values should shape our goals. What we want to achieve should be interpreted in the light of our values. And it's the nature of society, not just programs and services. And the example they gave was, we should be talking about income inequality, not just whether the general practitioners are available on Saturday nights. And now what we measure as we monitor progress should reflect what we want to achieve. And these are my words, not theirs, but the journey is important as well as the destination, how we get there. And they emphasized to me the importance of local ownership and collaborative working. I would say that what the people of Liverpool said to me, what the Commission on Social Determinants of Health was trying to do, and what just possibly a well-motivated faith-based community might want to do, is to contribute to a world where social justice is taken seriously. Thank you.
Thank you.